Buckcast, the Buckshot Boogaloo podcast, and I am here in the Thorn Manor, if you will, with the enigmatic, the stylish Jesse Thorn. Thank you, Jesse, for joining us here on the Buckshot Boogaloo podcast.
So happy to be here on the Buttcast. You said it's called the Buttcast,
It is called the Buttcast.
Yeah.
It is. And that's a play on words for those of you guys that are not as astute as Mr. Thorn. My first intro into your world actually came with your interview on Fangraphs.
Really?
Way back when, yeah. And it led me into the down the rabbit hole, the Thorn rabbit hole, if you will, that has opened my eyes and many other parts of my body to the Thorn aesthetic.
My aesthetic will get up in that ass.
It will get up in that ass, allegedly, into the hyperbolic chamber that that is my ass. A couple quick questions. Just quick.
I like the idea that it's a hyperbolic chamber and not a hyperbaric chamber. It's a place where you go to exaggerate things for rhetorical effect.
In a sort of a nebulous, metaphorical sort of way.
Unfortunately, the mistake that you made there is up my butt is actually a synecdochal chamber, which is where you go to refer to something by something with which it is associated.
Just to let you know, that was not a mistake.
Okay, gotcha.
There's no mistake happening there whatsoever. A couple quick questions. This is a baseball podcast, but my intent is for baseball to be the diving board into the giant pool of just general metaphor and life and pop and whatnot. The whatnots, if you will. But you are a Giants fan.
Yeah, I'm a native of San Francisco, so that is my, and I was born in 1981, so one of the Giants' peaks came right around my most impressionable age, which is to say 6 to 10 or 11.
Oh, sure.
12.
Yeah, well, which actually was something I was going to talk about, which is that that golden era, that pocket. So who are some of the golden era players for you? Your own golden era.
Man, well, my favorite Giant back then was probably Will Clark. But I loved. I mean, I loved that team top to bottom. I mean, I loved Brett Butler. I was a huge Brett Butler fan. I was a huge fan of bunting for a base hit.
One of the few players to make the transition from Giant to Dodger. Rather seamlessly.
I turned against him. Yeah. Let's be clear. I turned against him. Jose Uribe was a big favorite of mine. Robbie Thompson was a huge favorite of mine. Yes. Matt Williams. I mean, I'm basically just naming the entire starting lineup. Kurt Manwaring.
Sure, sure. And at that time, Kevin Mitchell, I believe, had joined the party.
I had a Kevin Mitchell poster on my wall that had him dressed up in caveman clothes, and it said, Middle Ages-y closed. I remember his bat was like giant and had spikes in it. Yeah, and it said Fee-Fi home run.
There was a whole that was also, I think, the golden era for posters in general. There was the Bash Brother posters.
Here in Los Angeles, there is this gallery called Gallery 1988 that has a dual show opening of what is that? Conseco Brothers or something, the company that made those posters. I had another one with Ricky Henderson that said Man of Steel.
Were they also the ones that did like the giant, like the spread eagle, for lack of a better term, Michael Jordan, two basketballs?
But their specialty, I think they did all types, but their specialty was the pun-based faux nickname with themed photograph.
Right.
And so they're doing a dual gallery show of half those posters and half art inspired by those posters.
Oh my goodness.
So we'll see what that turns out to be like.
It was also, not to track too far away from the Giants, which I'd love to get back to at some point. But it was also the golden age of baseball cards too. You had, I was born in 1980 myself. And I think everyone that was born within that cluster of people probably had at least one complete set of 1988 Tops.
Sure.
Probably the most worthless set of baseball cards ever, because every kid I know had one. I left mine unopened because I knew someday if it wasn't opened for whatever reason. And I'm not sure if that was the... the Billy Ripken, the infamous Billy Ripken, was in the 88 box, or maybe it was 86?
Billy Ripken, I think, was 1990 Fleer.
Was that a 1990 Fleer? Was the...
The fuckface card.
The fuckface card.
Am I allowed to say that on your podcast?
Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
I'm going to say 1990 Fleer, but I might be wrong.
Right. Which really is, might be the pinnacle of a baseball card dumb.
Every kid would have one 1988 top set, and every rich kid would have one 1989 upper deck set.
Fucking
rich kids.
I had a, it was like the pinnacle of, you know, my 1989 holiday season. I got a box, and I wasn't allowed to open it.
Wow.
Because there was a chance that the Griffey that was our equivalent of the whatever the 52 mantle, or you know, the 51, 52, whatever it is, that was going to be our generation's.
In that era, my dad's parents found his baseball cards, and my dad was born in 1943, I think, 43, 44 maybe. And so his baseball card, and he was a big fan of the Brooklyn Dodgers. He grew up in Kansas City, where they had, at the time, I think, a Dodgers farm team.
Okay.
And so he was a huge Brooklyn Dodgers fan. And so he had two Sandy Koufax rookie cards, just all kinds of crazy baseball cards. And my family was... let's just say not an affluent family. And I think we actually lived off of my dad's baseball cards for about 6 months. Yeah.
Selling them or
my dad was just selling them one at a time. Yeah. Wow. And I actually he's only saved two. He saved a 56 tops Roberto Clemente and a 56 tops Willie Mays, which I still have, in my closet actually right now.
What particular about those two?
I think they were just, he wanted to leave something to me.
He
knew I was a Giants fan. That's why Willie Mays. Yeah.
So back to the Giants. So, do you have any specific memories, about the Giants during that era? Obviously it was, the 89 World Series and the earthquake and all that. Were you a cognizant, human being in the Bay Area at that time?
I was absolutely. And my dad is an A's fan. I mean, my dad, having grown up in Kansas City, he abandoned the Brooklyn Dodgers, eventually, but he was an A's fan because of his relationship to the A's from Kansas City. And he also lived a long time in the East Bay. So my dad was a huge A's fan and I was a huge Giants fan. And my favorite Giant was Will Clark, and my best friend's favorite player was Jose Canseco. And so it was on in 1989. And of course the earthquake was, you know, the most traumatic thing that happened to me in my life.
Yeah.
And so my memories of the 89 World Series, for like for a lot of people from the Bay Area, are all mixed up with my memories of the San Francisco earthquake. And I remember my grandmother called the house to find out if we were okay, because she was watching the World Series on TV when the earthquake struck. And I think it was 5:04. And the game, because it was nationally televised on the East Coast, was supposed to start at 5:30 or something like that.
Sure, sure.
So they're all sort of, it's all a big jumble. But like a lot of people from the Bay Area, too, I was also an A's fan. I mean, not to the extent that I am a Giants fan, but, the rivalry is a very friendly one in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And so it was really exciting times to be an A's fan, too.
No, definitely, definitely. Did you get a chance to get to any of the games this past fall?
No, I didn't. I had to watch on television. I mean, the reality is that I have barely gotten to get to go to a game in San Francisco since they built that fucking new ballpark.
Right.
I mean, it's a lovely park, but I was just talking with a friend of mine about the experience of doing it, and he's not a big sports fan, but he grew up going to Orioles games in Memorial Stadium. Mm-hmm. And he still lives in the Bay Area. I live in Los Angeles now. And he was saying about how he felt like when he went to Pacific Bell Park in San Francisco, which is now called AT&T Park, he felt like he was inside of money.
Right.
That like every interaction he had with anything was financial.
Right, right.
So every surface is covered with advertising. Everything costs $14. You know, it's like it's a purely everyone is rich.
Right.
It's like a purely financial transaction. And that's a little bit like it's a little bit much for me to handle, frankly.
A little disconcerting.
I actually would rather, if I didn't hate the Dodgers so much, I would rather just go to Dodger Stadium.
Well, you could probably revel in your hatred by at least absorbing some of the vibes that are occurring at the stadium right now.
One of my best friends or a good friend of mine and a good friend of my podcast, Jordan Jesse Go, is this guy called Ashcon, and he's a rapper in the Bay Area. And he actually recorded a sort of Giants version of Don't Stop Believin' right before the playoffs started that ended up becoming this huge viral smash and ended up with several million views.
Yeah.
So cool. And he is now like, he now works for the Giants.
Oh, get out of town.
Yeah, he works for Fox Sports Bay Area or whatever the name of the channel that hosts, that plays Giants stations.
Sure.
He's called like the, I don't remember what they call him, the authentic fan or something like that. He does field pieces for them.
No way.
He's also an actor, very handsome and you're a very charismatic guy. So he was in their commercials, and it's actually the second time that a good friend of mine has been in a baseball team's commercials. The contributor to the Sound of Young America called Jim Real, mm-hmm. An old friend of ours from college, when he was in high school and college, used to play drums at the A's games in the outfield.
Oh, no way.
And he and a friend sort of started that. I think it may still be going on at the Coliseum.
It's a very old timey thing.
Yeah.
They had a
different chant for every player. I mean, I remember like, Tejada was one of them. They had Olmedo.
Olmedo
for Olmedo signs. So he was in a series of A's commercials at one point too. That's called living the dream, my friend.
No, there is something that comes with, that, you know, somehow being, you know, whatever success you might have or anyone that might has in the realm of entertainment, kind of being pulled into that mythical, magical world of baseball, has that extra pull. I don't know. Even for
MC Hammer, like when he was on the You Can't Touch This tour, and he was selling out stadiums and he was getting $20 million contracts to endorse Pepsi.
Sure.
He was thinking wistfully about when he used to be a bat boy for the A's.
His days as a bat boy for the A's.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty insane thing.
And telling people he was friends with Jose Canseco.
Which maybe he still is. Well, I'm not really sure. What are your thoughts? Have you been reading? Have you been keeping up on Jose Canseco's barrage of tweets?
Oh, Jose Canseco is so sad.
He
so
really
sad,
is.
Isn't it? I was just at my friends are these two comedians called the Sklar Brothers.
Sure.
They're twin brothers.
Yeah,
and they do a great podcast called Sklar Bro Country.
Yeah.
Very funny stand-ups as well. And I was over there doing a segment on their show, and the guest was Nate Cordry, who's a very, very funny and talented actor, a brother of Rob Cordry as well. And Nate Cordry told this story about how he was playing softball in L.A. somewhere.
Yeah.
And just Jose Canseco and his girlfriend came by and said, "Hey, can we play softball with you guys?"
I've got my own Jose Canseco softball story. It's
really?
Completely unrelated. Did he end up playing?
Well, I like that. I do like he did. Yeah, he played with them. And they said he was kind of weird, but it was kind of neat to play baseball with Jose Canseco, play softball with Jose Canseco. I like that he plays softball semi-professionally now.
Yeah.
It reminds me of another one of my favorite Giants. This he from the early 90s, Corey Snyder. Who actually may still be playing professional fast pitch softball. I know that he set the world record for home runs in professional fast pitch softball when he was like 43.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in baseball till his late 30s, you know. I do like the idea of, number one, I like all old baseball players except for Roger Clemens. And I like the idea of baseball players who won't quit.
Yeah.
I think that's so cool.
Well,
like some people think it's sad or pathetic or something. I just think it's great.
Well, you go back to, Satchel Paige obviously is the one that kind of jumps to the forefront of your head. And obviously, you know, there are probably many things under the surface as to why he felt the need to keep going, you know, this like, you know, a youth that was ripped away from him. I read some Rob Neyer article a couple of years back when Ricky Henderson was traveling with a lot of these independent league teams. And he said it's probably the closest thing you're going to get to seeing, you know, the essence of Satchel Paige. But are there any other old-time ballplayers that
Well, I mean, think of like I really, really wanted to fly. I almost actually at one point bought tickets to New York to go see Ricky play for the Newark Bears when he was playing in the Atlantic League.
Sure, yeah.
But Kevin Mitchell played in the Pacific League, I think it was called. It was an independent league that was mostly California teams. He played for a team called the Sonoma Crushers. I mean, I just think that is so cool. I met Larry Anderson once. I don't know if you remember him. He was a relief pitcher for the Phillies when the Phillies had their brief early 90s moment of greatness.
Was
sort
this
of
before
Lenny
or after
Dykstra.
He was on Night Court?
this is like the John Kruk era.
Okay.
And Larry Anderson was, he was famous for, I mean, I think at one point he was traded for Jeff Bagwell. That
yes.
was one thing
yeah,
he was
yeah,
famous
yeah.
for. And then another thing he was famous for was, I remember that when John Kruk had cancer, had testicular cancer, I remember Larry Anderson's big quote was, I sent him a fruit and nut basket in the hospital. I don't know if he likes fruit, but I know he'll appreciate the nuts. And so anyway, I met Larry Anderson when he was a player coach for the AA Scranton Wilkes-Barre Phillies.
What year was this? What year are we talking about?
This would be like, I think I was maybe, this would have been like 96 maybe, something like that. Like I would be about 15-ish.
Yeah. And he was a player coach.
He was a player coach, yeah. He wasn't playing a lot, but he was playing. And he was like their pitching coach / playing in games.
Which is a whole other side of baseball that's pretty fascinating, is the idea of the player coach. I can't think of another sport. You know, Tom Landry isn't feeling the itch to go out and take a few snaps.
Go out and Tris Speaker it up.
Or, I mean, some of the greats, you know, Rogers Hornsby, I think the most recent, probably, what wasn't Pete Rose a player manager?
Yeah, he
in the
was
80s.
A player
yeah.
manager in the 80s. I think that was the last one.
Just had its own.
Yeah.
Looking back on it, may not have been the best decision.
That's actually another example of an old baseball player I don't like. Yo. But most baseball players, if you make it to 40, I basically like you, and then if you make it to 42 or 3, I'm basically in love with you.
Sure, yeah, yeah, Jamie Moyer.
Oh, God, yeah, sure, like Jesse Orosco. Oh, God, I was in love with Jesse Orosco, not just because his name was Jesse, but when he was like 46,
yeah,
he was still sticking around. He's like,
in 95.
Because why not? Number one, the least amount of money you can get paid is like $500,000
a year.
Yeah, yeah. That is way more money than you could make doing anything else if you're a baseball player.
And once you settle into that middle relief zone, like pitch twice a week.
You don't even have to. You could be bouncing up and down between AAA and the majors. And if you're Jesse Orosco, you're still making 10 times as much money as you could doing anything else. Because what's he going to do? He's going to go sell cars, be a TV commentator.
Yeah. Yeah, there is that weird disconnect. Did you have any players that when you were a kid were traded and it kind of hit you in the gut?
I was so depressed when Kevin Mitchell got traded. It was the
who
whole
did he get traded for.
He got traded that? For Billy Swift. He got traded for Billy Swift was the big one, and then Dave Burba, and
hindsight's so funny on those
somebody
things.
Else yeah. But ended up really loving Bill Swift.
Oh, yeah.
So because he was such a fun, it's just always so fun to me. I mean, I think some people like to watch somebody strike somebody out, but I love to watch somebody pitch that just Billy Swift was completely dominant, throwing essentially one pitch, and it was a sinker. And
sure.
A guy who throws a dominant sinker is just the most fun thing to watch because it's just first swing, first pitch, swing, ground ball, first pitch, swing, ground ball. It just goes boom, 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 boom. And you're just like, how does this guy? And Billy Swift had that perfect control, too.
Right,
he had
right.
that like Bob Tewksbury level control.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
No, there was definitely an era when Derek Lowe was with the Dodgers where if it was a Sunday afternoon, you didn't have a whole lot of time, you had something to do at night. If Derek Lowe was pitching, you'd be out of there hour 45,
yeah,
maybe two.
Exactly.
2:10 was a little rough.
Yeah, that's really a fun thing to watch.
So you grew up listening, I'm guessing the sound in your ear was John Miller for most of your life?
It actually would have been Hank Greenwald
most of
the time. Yeah, Hank Greenwald was the main Giants play-by-play guy until...
Okay.
Until the Peter McGowan years of the Giants, when the Giants were sold. So
sure.
The sort of golden age of the Giants, which for me which was, you know, 87 to 93.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that time, almost all that time, it was Hank Greenwald, who's an exceptionally gifted player. Remains an ex. He fills
who's
in.
He
fills in once in a great while for the A's these days.
Okay.
But he's an exceptionally good radio play-by-play guy, good television play-by-play guy as well. And it was only that, you know, John Miller replaced him that softened the blow when he left.
Right.
And I think he retired.
Okay. Was he an influence on you being in broadcasting, or were any baseball announcers or anything like that? Was that part
yeah,
of your...
I think if you were going to say who was an influence on me going into broadcasting, I think Hank Greenwald would probably be number one.
Huh,
maybe Ira Glass number two.
Sure.
And I've met Ira Glass, but I have yet to meet Hank Greenwald. Yeah, I've interviewed him. I've had dinner with him and his wife. He's a super nice guy. I would love to meet Hank Greenwald. If anybody out there has a connection to Hank Greenwald,
I think that would be you.
Yeah,
he could be a young American.
But yeah, like Hank Greenwald was really inspirational to me. I mean, I think baseball being such a great radio sport.
Sure.
I mean, there were very good announcers in the Bay Area and in various sports, mm-hmm. but baseball is the one sport that actually really works on the radio. And so even though I was listening to, you know, Warriors games or whatever sometimes as well, I think it was that gave me the idea, like, this seems like it would be a cool thing to do.
Well, you hear, I mean, I know, Vin Scully often talks about, you know, which we're insanely blessed, to have here, doing Dodger broadcasts, but you're painting a picture.
Yeah.
And I imagine, you know, for you, even though, you know, most of what you do is interview or even just, you know, chat, if you will, you're still trying to create a picture. You're still trying to move something along. And even in those lulls, you're trying to, you know, create this thing that doesn't exist other than, you know, from what you're giving the audience, if you will.
You're always, I mean, the thing about radio broadcasting, especially live radio broadcasting, which is sort of what I do on, it's not really what I do on The Sound of Young America, where
right.
I interview people, but on Jordan Jesse Go, that's essentially a live program, although it's mm-hmm. distributed by podcast, is you're filling this space that will continue to go forward no matter what you do. So you have to be present and be interesting the entire time.
Sure.
You can't do what a television personality can do, which is let the picture speak for itself. You have to be there talking, or else people think their radio is broken.
Oh yeah. Sorry.
I was going to say, if you take, for example, Vin Scully, I mean, I think Vin Scully at this point in his career, you know, may or may not remember the names of all the players on the Dodgers, the time when he is magical is when he is just rambling.
there's a father and a son.
Yeah.
Spilled an ice cream cone.
That's what radio broadcasting requires. I mean, that's the thing that even like, you know, somebody I don't like, you know, somebody like Rush Limbaugh, you know, like I don't share his politics, but Rush Limbaugh is somebody who can ramble fascinatingly.
Sure.
And that's something that you need to have when you're doing live radio.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on podcasting in general? You've got a podcasting universe.
I'm in support of it.
You are in support of it.
That's my thoughts in general.
How long? So you've been in general in the grand scheme of things. So what got you into podcasting?
I've been podcasting since before podcasting existed.
Sure.
I've been podcasting since 2004.
Right.
Which is the very end, like December of 2004, I think, was when I started podcasting, and this was still 6 months or so before iTunes got podcasting support. So this was the very, very, very early days of podcasting.
Sure, yeah.
And I am not a particularly tech-y guy.
Mm-hmm.
I am what you might call, you might be able to call me a power user, but I definitely don't know how to program anything.
A power user as in?
I'm on my computer 16 hours a day.
not like you use your power for good and or evil.
Oh, no, no.
Jordan Jesse Go is a comedy podcast. We can all agree on that. And it makes me laugh out loud on many an occasion.
I think we can all agree on
that
too.
I think we can all, at least
I'll stipulate
to that.
Yeah.
Can agree on that. And I've heard, you know, others, particularly jumps in my head, the, you know, Chris Hardwick, I know you've had on the show, talk about, you know, for kids these days, for the youngins, these podcasts are the comedy albums of today. Were you turned on by any comedians at an early age? I mean, you obviously are dabbling in many worlds, and comedy is one of them. What's your comedic influence like?
Yeah, Chris Hardwick's theory that podcasts are the comedy albums of today is, I think it is a flawed one. But
I'd like to hear about that.
I don't think Chris Hardwick is flawed. I love that guy.
No.
But in terms of my comedy influences, I mean, you won't be surprised to hear that when I was, you know, 10, 11, and 12 years old, I was memorizing Dana Carvey, Mike Myers sketches on Saturday Night Live and obsessing over Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And, you know, that just progressed from there. I was obsessed with The Simpsons and news radio. Mm-hmm. And I think news radio is sort of like the junior entry level comedy geek thing that you could have before comedy geeks really existed.
Right.
Like that was the show that, you know, as brilliant as Seinfeld and The Simpsons were and are, mm-hmm. They were for everyone.
Right.
In a way that news radio was not. News radio was always a borderline failure.
Definitely.
You know, commercially. Borderline. Kept it just enough to make it into, you know, get it 6 years in and make it into syndication. But always a borderline failure. So that was really important to me. And it wasn't so much stand up. I mean, you know, I grew up after the era that stand up was after the era that stand-up was relevant.
Which it's always weird hearing people talk about it because I don't have that same, you know, I don't have, that's not in my brain. Like, no, you know, I'll listen to like Let's Get Small or something, or, you know, and that stuff's cool. And I really enjoy that type of thing. But that whole, you know, the working man's comic of the 80s, it doesn't ring true to me necessarily. Yeah. I can understand it, but.
I went to arts high school and I had fans who were who liked comedy and were funny. But when I went to college, I think the people that did The Sound of Young America with me in the first few years, Jordan Morris, who does Jordan Jesse Go mm-hmm. with me, and our friend Gene O'Neill, they were the first real comedy nerds that I knew and was friends with. And they're both brilliantly funny. Both of them, I'm sad to say, are much funnier than I am. But, you know, Gene loaned me his bootleg VHS of Mr. Show and his bootleg VHS of the complete run of Tenacious D that he got from some, like, underground video store in Los Angeles or something like that. And when I saw those... And I think Larry Sanders came out on DVD. The first season of Larry Sanders came out on DVD when we were like juniors in college. Those were transformational for me. And, you know, Jordan was and remains obsessed with Mystery Science Theater 3000.
As he should.
You know, like these and the kids in the hall in the state were huge amongst our friends. Mm-hmm. So those things were things that, because I grew up without, I didn't have cable or anything like that, so I didn't really get to see those things necessarily. The main things I got were either on network TV or they were like Monty Python I got probably from my parents.
Right.
Those things were just intense touchstones. And it's still kind of weird, frankly. Mm-hmm. I'm 30 now, that I could like... email people from Mr. Show.
Oh yeah, no, that's
you know, like we had Karen Kilgariff on. We've had Karen Kilgariff on Jordan Jesse, both Jordan Jesse Go and The Sound of Young America. She was one of the cast members of Mr. Show and famous for in my household for the scene that I think might be my wife's favorite comedy thing ever, which is it's a press conference being held by drunk ex-wives. Where she just sort of weaves up to the microphone and goes, "Oh, you men." Okay. But anyway, Karen is a super funny lady who was head writer of Ellen for a long time and stuff. Mm-hmm. And she came and did some bits on The Sound of Young America. And she just put out an EP, which is tremendous, by the way. You should Google her name and buy it. It only costs $3. And I just saw in the thing that I was in the list of special thank yous.
Get out of town.
And I was like, holy shit. Like, Karen, the Karen Kilgariff. I mean, it's a small community of people, admittedly, who would get, say, the Karen Kilgariff. But to me, that's still, like, really exciting. Like, it's exciting to me just that, like, I've met her and she's a cool lady.
Sure. Yeah. No, I can definitely hear you. I actually want to go back before we, I don't know, run too long or short. I don't know what your time is here. But, you'd started stirring a bit of controversy about 2 minutes ago with comments regarding a theory put forth by Chris Hardwick. But I'm actually curious about that because I'm actually I might be on board with you, but I can't read your mind and I'm not really sure what it is that you're going to say.
Well, I think podcasts have a very interesting relationship. I think the thing that is special about podcasts is that it gives you a direct access to a personality.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that can build a really strong relationship between you and that personality it's very different from stand-up.
Sure.
So I think maybe Chris, I think what Chris is saying is that when he was a kid, because he's 5 or 7 years older than me, the comedy album was that conduit to a person as a performer. That was the thing that they could go back to over and over.
Yeah.
But it definitely is very different. It's definitely a very different experience to, they're very, very different media.
Yeah. Well, I do find it interesting because you do have different podcasts and different podcasters doing different things. You know, the comedy Bang Bang podcast is more of a show. You know, it's interview, but it's, you know, people are doing a little goof, you know, throughout it. And
Scott Aukerman is essentially doing sort of a deconstruction of the role of host of a podcast.
Sure. Have you done,
trying to be as difficult as you can.
Yeah. Has he been into the Thorn Manor?
Yeah, sure. No, I've known Scott for a long time. Scott was
another
on
Mr. Show.
Yeah, exactly. A writer and sometime performer on Mr. Show. He was a guest on Jordan Jesse Go. He's been a guest on Jordan Jesse Go a number of times. Yeah. And in fact, he was on former writing partner BJ Porter were on The Sound of Young America, I think, maybe even all the way back when we were in college.
Okay.
I don't remember why. we had to come up with some reason to justify having them on. Like, these guys were on a show that you didn't watch 5 years ago. But they, not even that. They wrote for a show you didn't watch 5 years ago. But yeah, Scott's a great guy. And I think what he has done, what he and his partner Jeff have done at Earwolf is really great in terms of giving people a platform to share their amazing gifts. I mean, there's so many gifted comics. It's so great that we live in a world where there are so many opportunities for gifted comics to interface with audiences when, you know, if you just think it wasn't even, you know, 15 years ago or so that you could only do it on late night TV, or if you happen to get a network sitcom
for what, 5 minutes, and then if you're doing a network sitcom,
or you were one of the three people at any given time that had a show on Comedy Central,
right. And even with Aukerman and the things that they're doing with opening up to guests and stuff, it's often reminded me, even though it's not him doing it, of Phil Hendry. Didn't know if you're much of a Phil Hendry fan or not.
You know, I didn't grow up listening to Phil Hendry, but actually Jordan, my Jordan Jesse Go co-host, did. He's always been a huge commercial talk radio fan, and I think he sort of grew up with it. And he'll still listen. He'll openly admit to listening to listening to Dr. Laura will like calm him down. Like it's sort of like swaddling a baby.
I think it depends on what kind of mother you had, though. Because if like I hear Dr. Laura and it makes me cringe and like hide in a corner.
Yeah, well, Jordan's mother is nothing like Dr. Laura, but she did love listening to Dr. Laura.
Right.
And just hot talk in general. And so Jordan just feels at home when he's listening to hot talk radio. But Phil Hendry was a Southern California phenomenon.
Definitely,
at
yeah,
that time.
Yeah.
So in the time when Jordan was in high school, it was probably the peak of Phil Hendry's career,
right,
15
right.
years or so ago. And so it was a huge, huge thing for him. And I only got to know it later through listening. And, you know,
he's kind of gotten grouchier and.
Yeah. Well, he's gone through. I mean, he went through a long period where he was just being a traditional talk radio host again, didn't he?
I think where he kind of like lost the characters and wasn't doing that whole world as much. necessarily. What, on a mild segue, do you have any, do you have a desert island guest?
Randy Newman.
Randy, are you a Randy Newman fan?
I'm a huge Randy Newman fan. And, not only am I a Randy Newman fan, but when I was in college,
he's my obsession.
I interviewed Bob Edwards, the former host of Morning Edition, the host of the Bob Edwards Show on XM and Bob Edwards Weekend from Public Radio International.
Sure. Yeah.
And he came to our college radio station in Santa Cruz, California.
Randy.
Bob Edwards did. And I asked him what the best interview of his career was, and he said Randy Newman. I've been jealous of him ever since.
Have you seen him play?
I have, and it was great. Actually, Jordan and I went to see him in San Francisco, in North Beach in San Francisco, and it was just really a blast.
What's your favorite Randy Newman record?
Favorite?
Deep down the rabbit hole.
My number one favorite Randy Newman record. Well, the one that I laugh the most at is probably My Life is Good.
Sure.
Just thinking about the part where he describes going to visit his friend, Mr. Bruce Springsteen,
right.
and Bruce Springsteen says to him, "Ran, I'm tired. Will you be the boss for a while?" that's one of the funniest things in the history of music, as far as I'm concerned. Oh man, my absolute favorite Randy Newman song, though, in general, it's
too hard to pick. It is too hard to pick.
I love the Noom.
Do you see him? I mean, you have that sort of dry wit in your work, but at the same time, pulling on some heartstrings at times, but also kind of being in touch with pop culture and also having that humor. Do you see some Randy Newman-esque unreliable narrator in your own work? I mean, you want to be a reliable narrator, I guess, to the people you are actually.
You know who's a little bit like Randy Newman in a funny way, and I don't know if you. I hope you would consider this a compliment. It's certainly intended this way. It's my friend Tom Sharpling, who hosts the show The Best Show on WFMU. I think that he is taking a sort of Randy Newman like approach to radio hosting and to talk radio hosting specifically, in that his show is a series of call-ins, which some of which are fake. And his hosting is often sincere, but not always. And it's sort of an elaborate system of sort of strong opinions, where you're asked to essentially try and figure out who the real Tom Sharpling is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that element of always trying to find correlate the point of view of the character who's speaking and the point of view of the writer who's writing that character.
Sure.
Is a very Randy Newman-ish thing. And I think it's also in the way that it is, it's very dryly funny in a place where you wouldn't necessarily expect it to be.
Definitely. Before we go, my general question here is what the new sincerity.
Uh-huh.
I did a little Wikipedia research.
Sure.
What does that mean to you? What's going on there?
It's this thing that we made up when we were in college.
It's like folk rock.
it's this thing that we made up in college. I haven't been on about it too much in the last 5 years or so, but
so it's a dated reference.
Yeah, but I mean, I still support it. Essentially, I think that for people of my generation, and I'm 30 now, we sort of grew up in a world where to be cool or hip was to have a knee-jerk reaction of ironic scorn towards the world around you, and also ironic remove, that you would wear disco clothes but because you were wearing them you were cool, or that you would never try at anything because trying could show that you care too much. The sort of grunge aesthetics, which have some you know, there are certainly many wonderful pieces of art that were created in that context.
Of course.
But I think by the time I was in college in the, at the end of the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s, that had run its course. And I don't think there was anything left to, you know, you could just go buy your fake old t-shirt at the Urban Outfitters, and there just wasn't anything left to talk about.
Now you're there. Hesitant though for a second there. Have you kind of flipped on that, or is it kind of one of those things where you know,
no,
there's
still
always time for a change in the,
No, I'm still definitely in the place that I was in before. I think the only thing that I have, so I'll explain what, I'll get to the explanation of what it was. I
sure.
think the new sincerity was, rather than just being what we used to call the old sincerity,
right?
It was about things that were large in some way, like almost too large to contain. Things that were ridiculous or outlandish or in some way uncool in the Miles Davis sense of cool, but needed to be celebrated because they were amazing. And that could be anything from like, you know, I think the theme music of The Sound of Young America is this this sort of easy listening band of Jordan Jesse Go is this easy listening band called the Free Design from the late 60s, early 70s that were rediscovered by the sort of Stereolab type generation in the 90s called the Free Design. And they have this song called Kites Are Fun.
Right.
And it's just about kites and how great they are. But it is a beautiful evocation of this simple, wonderful thing. And it's not, it's like so, it's so simple that it's almost ridiculous.
Right.
It's called Kites Are Fun.
Right.
But it's wonderful. It's really a joyful, beautiful thing. I think in the other side, you know, like I think the classic examples would be like, I don't know, like Parliament Funkadelic.
Right.
You know, that's something that has real content, even though it's absolutely absurd and ridiculous. And it's not just a deconstruction of something. It's not just a satire of something. It's a real thing. And it is expressed through this explosion.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Or Dolly Parton, you know, like Dolly Parton is someone who completely absurd.
Yeah.
Like Dolly Parton could not be more ridiculous, but also could not be more real. And so if you are appreciating Dolly Parton ironically, you're a fucking dick because Dolly Parton is amazing.
Yeah.
Dolly Parton is a brilliant, brilliant singer and songwriter. And she is just so Dolly Parton that one's reaction, if one is in the film Reality Bites or whatever,
right,
is to be like, oh yeah, wink, wink, wink.
Right.
When in fact the proper reaction is to embrace that and just ride that wave.
Ride the beauty of
exactly
Dolly Parton. Even if Dolly Parton doesn't necessarily see her own beauty, which is a whole other bit of deconstruction in and of itself.
And that was sort of what we wanted to do. And, you know, we also enjoy, I also definitely enjoyed, there was a long period where one of my hobbies was declaring things either new sincerity or not new sincerity, which was a lot of fun. That was really fun, actually. That was part of it. I mean, the idea of just declaring things something or not something was definitely a key part
this
of the new sincerity.
This being a new, this
yeah,
being old.
Exactly. And so it was that. And I mean, as I get older, you know, I get more and more comfortable with what you might call the old sincerity.
Sure.
But I still really, you know, I'm a very conservative person in some ways. Mm-hmm. I think that I mean, for somebody who runs his own media empire and has,
we can call it that,
hasn't had a real job in 5 years and, you know, all these crazy things that I've done with, you know, professional podcaster, nutty person. I'm still also sort of a conservative guy, not a risk taker, but it is that sense of the possibility of the world that really inspires me about that kind of thing. I mean, I think one of the best friends ever of The Sound of Young America, a guy who has, and Jordan Jesse Go, a guy who's been on our show many times, and is just probably my favorite guest on the show ever, is Andrew W.K. And
sure,
Andrew is this guy who has built his career around the idea of partying. And I think that when he came out, people thought, what is this? Is this guy an idiot? Or is this guy a joke?
Oh, it's his shows are mind-blowingly vibrant. But yeah,
those were the things that people, because they only had Old Sincerity or Irony.
Yeah.
Right? And he's neither of those things. Andrew W.K. has absolutely mindfully created this character. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, he picked out a crazy outfit that he always wears and so on and so forth. But it's not a cynical move at all. He has dedicated his life to the spirit of kind of feeling out of time and feeling purely joyful, that he has just picked the word party to describe. And everything that he does is about driving towards that.
Sure.
This thing that is like so, it's something that you just can't catch in a bottle, you know? It's something that you have to be in a state of pursuing it. That's the only way that you can, you know what I mean?
Well, in a sense, he's like a modern day tramp in a way, in his own his essence, in a sense.
Charlie Chaplin. Yeah. Like he's a guy who, you know, he just wants to bring people into this state of abandon and joy in anything. And that's why when Andrew W.K. tweets a thing that says like he's having a, you know, chocolate chip pancake party or something like that, or
he's having this banana party.
Andrew knows that's funny. He's not a fucking idiot. He's a really bright guy. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't mean it, that he doesn't think that like what you should be driving towards is celebrating the moment that you're in.
Of course.
You know, whether even if it's just eating a banana. I mean, he is a guy who genuinely sees how wonderful bananas are. You know what I mean? And they are. They're fucking really good, right?
They're delicious.
And that is something that I admire so much about him. And that's something that doesn't fit into that binary of old news, new news, right?
Right, right.
We get it, the sort of we get it and you don't version of, you know, 1994, or the, you know, we're all in Sing Along with Mitch, 1961, right? Yeah, yeah. And that is, to me, that's what we tried to do. That's what my goal is with the New Sincerity. And it's not something that I can like, you know, it's not something you can do all the time, or, you know, it's very difficult to do would be all the time, but it's something that you can believe in and try and make part of your life to the best way that you can. And I, like I said, it's hard for me, like to be the exemplar of this or something like that. I don't think I am the exemplar of it.
Standing on the mountain of sincere.
I'm a risk averse, you know, not that outrageous kind of guy. But, and I don't think I'll ever be a different kind of guy, especially now that I got a kid on the way. But,
right.
But that is what I think was something that was missing from the discourse that we, you know, jokingly and also not jokingly created the New Sincerity around.
Right, right. Which is it's a fascinating thing, and I do believe we are running quickly out of time here.
I can just bring it back and say that Ricky Henderson is New Sincerity.
Ricky Henderson is New Sincerity in its fullest extent of joy and burstful.
Especially when he's doing sit-ups and pull-ups at home by himself.
Probably backflips as well.
Hundreds of sit-ups and pull-ups every night.
He does not use weights.
He does not believe in weights.
He does not use weights. He doesn't believe in weights. Fascinating. And with that, I do believe I've got a sign-out I'm working on. Do you have a sign-out that you use?
No, you mean like angels fly because they take themselves lightly or something
like that? Yeah. So mine on my first, which it's not really a sign-out if you have to explain it. but I think my wife's calling.
Uh-huh.
Because the first podcast she was calling.
Right.
Which is kind of ruining the sign out. But with that, Mr. Jesse Thorne, creator, purveyor of an empire. I think my wife's calling, so I do have to go. But thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of the Buckshot Boogaloo Podcast. The Buttshot Boogaloo Podcast.
I am going to drop my own new sign out that I just created in my mind.
Oh,
it's after Milton Berle. Milton Berle's famous words when challenged to a dick size contest by a younger comedian. I've been Jesse Thorne. Okay, but I'm only taking out enough to win.
goodbye.